No matter where you are on the face of the earth, you have family. And so it was good to visit with the brethren down in North Hickson in Chattanooga. And glad to be back, though. Always good to be home. It's good to leave, better to come back, as they say. So what I'd like to do this morning very quickly, and thanks to Alex, by the way, for filling in for me, is just to touch on some things in chapter 12 and then go on into chapter 13, which is the account of the two beasts, the sea beast and the land beast. Here's the sea beast, as it's rendered by this artist. There's the land beast coming up out of the ground, mesmerizing and trancing the population of the world. Both of these beasts respond to the power of the dragon that we learned about in Revelation 12. So very quickly, there's a great sign in heaven, as the scriptures say, and the sign is that there's a woman in labor. She's favored by God, whoever she may be, and we know this because she's clothed with the sun. She stands on the moon, indicating higher than even celestial things. She wears a crown, and she has a garland of 12 stars around her head. Now, as is typical with apocalyptic literature, and as is typical in Revelation, there's no specific statement about who this is. And then there's another sign, as the chapter says. There's a great fiery red dragon that has 7 heads and 10 horns. And if you're familiar with the book of Daniel, this should kind of ring a bell, because there are several beasts in the book of Daniel, not this specific one. This one seems to be kind of a sum or a mixture of all of the beasts of Daniel. But this beast has these symbols of authority, 7 heads and 10 horns. And then a child is born, the child that the woman was in labor to deliver. A child is born who has authority to rule all nations with a rod of iron. This child is precious to God and is taken away to heaven. And then the woman flees to the wilderness to get away from the dragon, to a place that's been prepared for her by God, where she stays for 1260 days. There's that number again. And 1260 days, do you remember, it's equal to how many months? 42. And 42 months are how many years? 3.5. And sometimes we believe that's equivalent to a time, times, and half a time. Phrases that we see in Revelation and Daniel. So she flees away from the dragon to a place prepared by God, where she stays for a predetermined amount of time. What are the 1260 days? Many things that scholars have said about that. Again, this is a study where we're trying to understand the basics of the book and not get off into too much speculation. All right, keep going. We understand that the child that's born is Jesus. The Messianic Psalm, Psalm 2, refers to the Messiah as ruling with a rod of iron. Some students of Revelation say it could also refer to the church, the bride of Christ. There's arguments for that, arguments maybe not so much in favor of that, but the actual phrase itself is associated with Christ. And so there's a victory. Jesus is taken up into heaven. Now, did that ever actually happen? Of course, after his resurrection. We understand that the dragon is Satan because we're told that in verse 9. You know, occasionally, even in Revelation, there's just a definite statement of fact to help us understand. So this dragon who's battling with the woman and battling with her child is Satan, the ancient deceiver, the one who lied from the very beginning. The next thing we see is a war in heaven. And the archangel Michael and his angels fight with Satan and his angels, and Satan loses and is expelled from heaven. Now, one of the things we read is this figurative? Was there literally a battle in heaven? How are we to see this? And what it says is that there's war, there's conflict, and that Satan loses. So there's a second statement of victory in chapter 12. And more than simply, if we can use that word in this context, a conflict between two forces or two groups in heaven, the saints are also victorious in all of this, because verse 11 says that through the blood of Christ and by their testimony of faith and even by martyrdom in some cases, they participate in this victory and have overcome. So far in chapter 12, up to this point, we see two statements of victory. And that's all you're ever going to see. All you would ever want to see when it comes to God and His cause and His people. The ultimate outcome is always going to be victory. And you think, well, martyrdom is not a victory. Spiritually, it is. And so the issue here is not the things of this world that we want to cling to, including our eyes. The issue is a clarity of what victory really is, and the fact that that victory is not only attainable, but inevitable for those who belong to God through Christ. There's no other possibility. It's guaranteed. So, Satan comes down, he's cast out of heaven, he comes to earth, and now there's war on earth. So the dragon now persecutes the woman, but she flees to the wilderness for 1260 days. Is this a second 1260 days? The same as verse 6. Same context, same chapter, same set of issues. Probably the same as verse 6. But again, the distinction, one way or the other, is not clearly there. The dragon spews water to carry the woman away. In other words, out of the dragon's mouth comes this flood. The idea is to wash the woman away, but the earth swallows up the dragon's flood and saves the woman. Now, first and foremost, third image of victory here. The woman cannot be defeated even by Satan. Now what we see as the chapter ends is the dragon turns its attention to the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Who would they be?
Us.
Christians, yes. That's who that would be, pretty much clear. So one question here then is, what is this water? What is the dragon doing? Why is the image of water used? And many scholars who have studied this say that this is the dragon's attempt to deceive humankind, to overwhelm the church and its message with error, sin, temptation, whatever it may be. Good argument. Is that what this means? I don't know. I'm not sure. But whatever the dragon does, it's against the church, it's against God, and that's the general idea here. But the earth swallows the flood. The earth may absorb, in the sense of the people in it, what the lies of the devil are, that the deceits, that sort of thing, that's always been the case. But it will not defeat or destroy the church. Thoughts? Questions? Sometimes you read this and you see hints and indications, but it doesn't ever answer all of the questions.
You know, it makes sense with that dragon spewing. Hitler believed what was called a cultural stream. And he said if you get enough people going in a direction, it doesn't matter how many people stay on the side. And the homosexual movement would use that same exact thing. They wouldn't even tell you they used the Hitler concept. So it makes sense.
You know, that's a very good point. Years ago when I may have mentioned this, when I was in college working on my second career as a therapist, there was a woman at Virginia Tech. I didn't go to Virginia Tech, but I took a couple of classes there. And there was a woman there who was, in her mind, openly lesbian. And her argument was the standard argument that, you know, I was born this way. You're bigoted and small-minded if you say anything against me because we're not responsible for how we're born. Yet when she went into class to teach her students, which was supposed to be about family therapy dynamics but was really just her pulpit for preaching homosexuality, she went into class and she'd say, I can convert any woman to lesbianism. here's my challenge. And she said this to her students. And this is the kind of thing, if I'm understanding what Joel's saying, that kind of fits into this. You know, you just tell a monstrous lie. Just overwhelm people. And so she would say, here's my challenge and my promise to you students. You pick the bar. Interesting that she set a bar. You pick the bar, you pick the day, you pick the time, we'll go in together, you pick the woman, and I'll walk out with her. Can you imagine such nonsense? That's not going to happen. But that was her claim. And she made it with such force and such assertion that those kids in that class didn't dare, in their own minds, speak up or challenge her. And this is how people get away with this nonsense. The young don't know any better. They're being programmed in the schools today. Even more conservative schools still have this stuff. What do you think, Dietra? Some of that? Even here in this state of Tennessee. And you don't have teachers in the grade school saying what this woman, at least I don't think you do, saying what this woman said in this college class. But this movement is pervasive. Satan doesn't let up. He doesn't stop. And the more outlandish, the more bizarre, the more absurd, the more people are kind of pushed back, not sure what to say. And so I got in trouble in that class because I'm just sitting back there shaking my head. And of course she saw that. And she said, well, Mr. Walker. And so we had a little exchange, and she said, maybe you don't belong in this class. It's not a matter of whether or not I belong, so I've got to take this class to get my degree.
It seemed like what she's saying is that she was born that way and couldn't help it, but she can make people that wasn't born that way accept that lifestyle.
Totally contradicted herself.
Crazy.
And it wasn't because she didn't know. She preached one doctrine to the public. That was the public message. But she had another very arrogant thing that she said when she was in the classroom. Hubris. One of the most self-destructive attitudes a person can have is that kind of pride. Because you'll end up making a fool of yourself. And she probably thought that she would always get away with it. Maybe she did. I don't know. Because nobody would dare challenge her. Very influential, very much out there, very much of an attitude of don't mess with me because if you do, I'm right, therefore you're wrong. And so Satan fights. And we as Christians can get intimidated, and we shouldn't be intimidated. We shouldn't go to the opposite extreme, like some people do, and walk into homosexual bars or facilities or abortion clinics and start killing people. I don't see in the scriptures where God commands Christians to do any such thing. But we should not be afraid. And if somebody wants to do the finger in the chest routine or get an attitude or start labeling you and calling you a bigot or a fool or stupid, don't get angry. Don't back up. Don't attack or say something foolish. Just calmly stand your ground. And respond to that with a conviction of truth. Because God has the truth. Satan is nothing but lies. And the point of that is not that you're automatically going to convince anyone who's against the Word of God. How wonderful that might be if it were that easy. The point is, you don't need to be afraid. So don't be afraid.
You know, we're men, our children and ourselves, you know, since the Dolan girls, Archie, and the whole nine yards, they've got this in, and you know, Archie was always against stuff like that. But you know, they beat him down because he, you know what I mean, he was just a redneck. And then on to the Dolan girls, and then she was always a dummy because she always kind of, you know, she wasn't raised that way and she couldn't understand. She was always a dummy and you know, the homosexuals and the people like that were labeled. In the same way, we're getting pushed down our throat. Evolution the same way, as you see these programs. everything. Global warming, the whole nine yards. You see what they could do. They had on Earth Day about all the global warming and all that. There may be a bit of truth in it, but I don't think it is. I think it, in 20 years, you won't even hear anything about it.
That's because 90% of our professors, like you was talking about, are bigoted, liberal, predominantly socialists.
Well, see, you're bigoted and liberal because you said that. Don't you know that? One of the easiest ways to put people on the defensive is to put them up against an idea that you're dumb, stupid, uninteresting, unattractive, whatever it may be, if you don't agree with us. Or if you don't agree with us, you're going to have to face our criticism, and that's going to be intense. And it's always been that way for Christians. And we might say, well, you go back 150 years, it wasn't that way. 150 years ago, the way it was is not the way it is. But there has always been opposition for Christians. And rather than wring our hands about that, I think the thing to do is to understand that, but more than that, to recognize that when we are Christ's, we do not need to be afraid. As long as we don't let go of what God has given us, that we've accepted, as long as we don't let go and turn away and walk back into the world, our victory is assured. Because God and the Lamb cannot be overthrown. So this is what we see in chapter 12. This worldwide conflict is introduced in these terms. But God protects the child. God protects the woman. Now, who is the woman? Two or three classes back, Joel made an observation that, looking back on it, should have asked him to talk about it. So I'm going to ask him if he wants to in a minute to expand. But the idea is, does any of this that we're reading possibly go back to before Christ and who God's people were leading up to Christ? In other words, the Jews, those who were faithful back then. One interpretation of who the woman is that God is protecting, we'll get to that in a minute, but getting ahead of myself here, she's not Mary in the sense of Mary being the earthly mother of Jesus incarnate. We see that by how she's described. So who is she? And what could all of this represent? Because there is a continuing pattern, a plan from the beginning that God has put in place. Nothing has been able to stop it, nor will anything ever be able to. Whether it's Haman during the time of the Persian Empire and Esther, or whoever it might be who might propose, whether they know what they're doing or not, to interfere with the plan of salvation. People can make efforts, but they will always fail. So we come back to that in a minute. And Joel, maybe if you want to comment, feel free. If not, that's fine too. So, if the child caught up to heaven is the Christ, who's the woman? Mary? Probably not. Why do I say that? Well, for one thing, she wears a stephanos. This is a type of crown, a garland that's woven. It's a crown of victory. It's similar to what the Romans used to give their commanding generals. A grass crown, right after a battle on the field when the Romans had been victorious, which for many centuries was almost always the case. The soldiers would go out into the field and pull grass up out of the field that was stained with the blood of the defeated. And they would weave that into a crown and give that to the general. He'd get all kinds of things when he got back to Rome. But the generals viewed that grass crown that they wore, that garland stained with the blood of the enemies, is the greatest honor that a military leader could have. And they would usually keep those things through the years. And the grass would degrade, but they would keep the grass crown. And what she's wearing is kind of similar to that. It's a crown of victory. Her appearance is more spiritual than physical. And so in Micah, and we're not going to read that here, Micah 4 through 5-4, We read at the establishment of the church that the arrival of the Messiah is going to be preceded by a restoration of a remnant of Israel, which we know happened. And so the passage in Micah is understood to be in the time of Christ, referring to when the Messiah would come. And so one way to understand the woman in the context of the scripture is that she is the spiritual precursor to Christ, the restored Israel. So I'm not saying that is definitely the way to see her. I'm saying it's probably not Mary. But who would she be? Just a representation of God's plan? She's not the church. The church is the bride of Christ. Joel, any thoughts about that? Not trying to put you on the spot. Just...
I guess you're making reference to the when I mentioned Moses and the prophets and stuff when we were dealing with it earlier.
All of the plan throughout the old law.
The war started in Genesis chapter 3. And so it's not like, you know, we're getting a picture of the church short term, but overall the war has been going on since Genesis chapter 3. And so, yeah, it may be those things that led up to Christ, that gave birth to Christ, that provided God the opportunity to bring Christ into the world.
There's ways that you can look at this battle between good and evil. And there's all kinds of questions even about the garden. You know, why did God allow that? Well, God has, from the beginning, allowed us to have choice. And that choice, in humankind being confronted with it, has to begin somewhere. And began right in the garden. And so there's always been this struggle within us between our carnal side, our fleshly side, and our spiritual side. Paul very eloquently, poignantly talks about that in Romans 7 and 8. But the message even in Romans 7 and 8, as it should be, is while we struggle and we do things that we don't want to do, we're at war within ourselves. There's part of us that wants nothing to do with sin, and yet we still sin. By the time you finished Romans 8, you understand there's a victory coming for those who will endure and stay in the battle and keep fighting. And that battle's been there. We see it throughout human history. Any other thoughts or comments? Thank you, Joel. All right, let's get into Revelation 13. And would someone please read to get us started the first 8 verses of Romans 13. I think I may have said 17. If I did, I meant 13. Anyone wish to read? Go ahead, Sanford.
And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet was like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and his great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemous against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them, and authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain.
All right. Pretty dramatic, horrible-sounding creature. Who is this creature, this sea beast that comes up out of the ocean? Who is it under the influence of?
Satan.
Okay, and how do we know that it's under the influence of Satan? Okay, the beast, the dragon. The beast is in subjection to the dragon, and the dragon is Satan. So this is clear because Revelation says so in so many words in a non-figurative way. So let's take a look. There's a sea beast. He says he stands on the sand of the sea. He's on the beach, and he sees this beast come up out of the sea. It has 7 heads and 10 horns, 10 crowns on its horns, and across its head, written up on its heads, is a blasphemous name. What's blasphemy? Speaking against God. Blasphemy can also be saying you're God or trying to take the place of God or claiming to have God's abilities, if you will. All of these things are blasphemy. And so whatever is written is of that nature. And so now we see the beast described once again in a very demonic kind of way. You think about the locusts that we've seen described and other creatures. So here he says, the beast he saw is like a leopard, its feet are like the feet of a bear, its mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gives him his power, his throne, and great authority. So we see that there's authority, and that kind of matches this idea of 7 heads, 10 horns. Horns in the scriptures represent power, the ability to overcome. And then on his horns are 10 crowns, this idea of majesty or ruling at a very high level. So whatever or whoever this beast is, this is kind of the image. So one of its heads has a mortal wound, except that the wound had healed. The beast is not really dead, even though the wound should have killed it. And all the world is amazed at this, and they're very impressed with, and they follow the beast. And so we see here all the world. And interestingly, some writers argue this means everyone, including Christians, because it says all the world, and Christians are in the world. But we understand in the Bible the differentiation between the world and the saved. And there's no reason to make any other interpretation other than this is carnal humankind, but not the saved. So they worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And so they speak of the beast in this idea that he's invincible because he has this wound that appears to have, or not appears to have, but it's healed in the vision. So let's keep reading. He was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. Again, you know, horns, heads, crowns, given power to rule by the dragon. So he's going to speak out with great pride and blasphemy. He's allowed to do this for a period of time, 42 months, 3.5 years, 1,260 days. And so he blasphemes God, verse 6. He blasphemes his name, his tabernacle, those who dwell in heaven, attacking God. And so the dragon, Satan gives him this power, and he begins to do what Satan does. And it was granted to him. In other words, he can't do this on his own. He was given the freedom to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. Now, understanding the Bible as a whole, what do we know has to be the limitation of the boundary conditions on the idea of this beast having authority to overcome the saints? Is he going to destroy the plan of salvation? No way. Or now we found a verse that contradicts the whole scheme of redemption. So if he can overcome the saints, but this does not contradict the scheme of redemption, what do we know this must mean? What kind of overcoming, what kind of power does this beast, whatever it is, have?
He puts them under subjection or kill them.
Okay, he'd be able to kill them physically or imprison them, persecute them in any one of a number of ways. But take away their salvation? No. That's not possible. The scriptures are clear.
It reminds me of Job. You know what I'm saying? He'd done it everything to him to take his life.
Yep.
But he still told his wife, said, you like one of the foolish yep. women? I said, hey, you know, naked I come into this world. You know, naked I'll leave. You know, blessed be the Lord.
And let's apply that to what we're reading in Revelation. Job starts out with a discourse between God and Satan. And many times people approach Revelation as there's going to be this contest. Who's going to win? Contest between God and the devil. And there's poor Job, the clueless victim of this. And he was clueless. All right, no question. That we can, at least, not at the end, but until then, he was. Although not as clueless, maybe, as we might say, he at least knew to hang on to God no matter what. But God told Satan at the start, look, this is the way Job is. He holds fast to his integrity. He's a good man. And Satan's arguing with that. There's no question. God's right, and from the very beginning, if you look at it that way, the outcome is already known, even though we haven't read the whole book. And so Job did endure. He did remain steadfast. And what happened in the end? What's always going to happen? Satan loses, and those who are steadfast win. And that's the outcome for Job. That's the outcome that we read about in Revelation, in more dramatic language, perhaps, for all of humankind. There's only two options, with God or without Him. God's going to win all the time, every time. Satan is ultimately going to lose, period.
You know, he talks about, he gives protection to his plan overall, and then he also talks about other places in Scripture that have given us protection as individuals. And I love this description here of the devil. He's constantly through the Scriptures telling us what the devil is, and something you don't want to be close to, but yet we flirt with that. And if you could actually visually see something like this, you would run. But we don't do that. We flirt to the edge of it sometimes.
Right. We toy with it. We have a hard time with our carnal nature. We want to find out where the fence is, as though there were a fence, a boundary that's specific like that. And we want to push up against that fence. And get as close over there and kind of dangle one hand over into carnality, but still say, well, I'm safe because the rest of me is over here with God. The Scriptures don't teach that. That's a human concept. God says, come close to me, seek me, come and crowd around me, get under my wings. I'm your protector, your savior, your loving parent. Don't go out into the field and trifle with sin and think that you can do that. You might get away with it one day, but ultimately that's going to destroy you. That's how it is.
One other side of that too is if we don't do that, then we marvel at it from a distance and it scares us. I was talking to the girl
last night.
We were talking about Russia flying two nuclear bombers near the Alaska. And, you know, and the world's heating up at war again. I mean, it really is. And we may go to war, and it's not something we want, but at the same time, it's absolutely nothing for us to be afraid of. Isaiah 40 says, you know, the nations are a drop in my hand, a drop in a bucket, they're nothing. So either we do what Sanford said, we chase up as close to them as possible, or we cower in the corner, and both of them are wrong.
All of these images that we see in Revelation are echoed in the prophets. And one message throughout the prophets is no matter what's going on, God is not only aware of it, but He is over all of it. Now, God sees China. He sees Russia. He sees us. He sees all things. Well, somebody might say that if God really loves us, He won't let us suffer. And we've talked about those things here in past months. God will permit us to experience trials to make us stronger, to test our faith. Not in the testing in the sense of going to school and passing a math quiz, testing in the sense of trying and refining with the intent of purifying and strengthening us. And that's the whole idea here to these Christians who are undergoing all kinds of chaos and uncertainty. and sometimes not uncertainty, definite persecution, that God sees all this. None of this changes or nullifies the plan of salvation. You be strong, you be patient, you endure, because the reward is guaranteed. So let's
Mm-hmm.
This isn't an intellectual exercise. God is calling us to come to Him from the heart, to obey from the heart the things that we read in the Bible, to reject traditions or worldly concepts, habits, to push all of those things out, and whether it's alien to our thinking or not, to come to Him and to obey, to believe in Christ from the heart, not just intellectually, to recognize that there's a God, because all of this that we see in the world cannot have come from the mind of man or just an accidental series of events over billions of years. So to be convicted in our minds of God, to see that the Bible is internally consistent, it teaches us of Christ, tells us to believe in Him, tells us to obey Him, which includes figuratively participating in His death, burial, and resurrection through baptism, living a life of loving obedience, enduring what life may bring us, knowing that our salvation is secured. The world doesn't want to hear it. But those who will hear, as Jesus said, those who have ears to hear, let us hear, and once we hear, let us obey. And there are many things that push people away, or that people let push them away, I should say. Whether it's tradition, or, well, that's not what I've always thought, or that's not how my family is, there's no God. If there were a God, things would be different. Why do you say that? Because that's what I think. I'm not going to submit myself to a book, to words that are written in a book. All kinds of reasons that people let push themselves away from the Lord. And yet everything in the Bible assures us of that victory, and everything in the Bible tells us to live a life that is good. Good for us, good for others. It may be inconvenient at times compared to creature comforts, but everything that we're told to do in the Scriptures by God is good. All right, let's keep moving. So verse 8 says that the beast is going to be followed by all who dwell on the earth. They'll worship him except those whose names have been written in the book of life. They're excluded. Those who are worshiping are those whose names have not been written in the book. So those who are saved aren't being talked about here. The world is going to follow the allurement of this beast who is under the control of Satan. So, some things quickly about the sea beast. Comes up out of the ocean, an appearance from purely physical things. The ocean symbolically can represent just the world and everything in it. Is that what it means? Don't know, but it comes up out of the sea. A similarly described beast comes up out of the bottomless pit in Revelation 17. We haven't gotten there yet, we will. Is it the same beast? Don't know. This beast has 7 heads, 10 horns, 10 crowns, worldly authority and power, given to it by Satan, who is the prince of this world. It has a blasphemous name, one that should only be used for God himself, or one that curses or in some way usurps God. The Roman emperors use such names. Some people argue that a lot of what Revelation is talking about, this conflict between God and the beast and powers of Satan, is conflict between Christians in that day and the Roman Empire, who, as the years passed, became more and more into this cult of emperor worship. The emperors liked the idea of being put forth as gods and included in the pantheon of Roman gods as beings that the people should worship. Another argument that's made is that this refers to the Roman Catholic Church, and the claims of the Pope, those claims did not exist necessarily at the point in time that Revelation was written, but they increased in the centuries right after, that the bishop in Rome should be the prelate or head of the church on earth. Both ideas fit the pattern to a point. Are either of them correct? I don't know. One thing I can say is, based on Revelation 1 and the idea that the message was, at least in part, about things that were coming, that were to happen soon, it may be that one or both of these are what was intended. Back to the beast. The beast is demonic in its appearance. It's not a real physical earthly animal. Looks like a leopard, but it has bear's feet. On the heads are lion's mouths. One head's mortally wounded and yet not. You know, a mortal wound means guaranteed death, but it's not dead. It's healed. The beast is sort of a compilation, a collection of all of the beasts in Daniel 7 combined into one. That's just an aside. What we could conclude from that, other than that Daniel 7, to some extent, or the end of the book of Daniel, tracks some of what's talked about in Revelation, which is probably true. Just pointing that out really is all we're saying here, is calls to mind the book of Daniel. So this is kind of the origin and the appearance of the beast. It has power given to it by Satan. It has a throne and great authority, but for a lengthy but limited period of time. What is this throne? Where is it? Is it a physical throne, or is it figurative in the sense of the authority as though it had a throne? Don't know. It's given authority over all nations and peoples. In other words, its influence is very, very widespread. It's not just one province or town or region in the Roman Empire or anywhere else in the world. The world's astounded by this beast. And so they worship both the beast and the dragon, saying, you know, who's like him? He received a mortal wound, but he didn't die, so who's able to fight him? Those in the world who are not saved are going to be caught up in this, and they'll worship the beast. And notice how the saved are described, those whose names are written in the book of life. That refers to God's people. Those people are not included in the ones who are under the influence or the sway of the beast. We'll get to persecution next time, and we're going to do some comparisons between this beast and Christ that may help us see that the beast is probably a pretender. Part of the blasphemy is that the beast appears to the world to be like Christ. So thanks for your attention, your comments. We'll pick up here next time. Let's take a break before we begin our worship.